I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. Our topic today, Interview Techniques 3.0 Part 2. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services, and I'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items, and we'll jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time, Lighthouse provides in-depth work style and personality assessments for both new hire candidates and for staff development. We also offer a number of workshop topics to associations and trade organizations. If you'd like more information, please email me as indicated on your screen. Our Keeping on Track open line series is in response to a number of calls we've been getting from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that most organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program. On your screen, you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we'll open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. You'll also want to have some paper and a pen handy to take notes, since we'll be sharing many ideas that you'll want to consider and implement with your team and trusted advisors. Our special guest who's with us today is Brad Remillard, who is a longtime friend, business colleague, cool guy, knows his stuff, and is an expert on this topic. Many of you know Brad from his best-selling book, You're Not the Person I Hired. I refer to this book as the Bible of hiring. If you don't have it, I would suggest getting it, and you can see where to get it on the screen. Brad has over 30 years of experience as an executive recruiter and is a well-recognized national speaker on the topic of how to hire right the first time. Today, Brad will be sharing some of the techniques that he teaches in his workshops, CDs, and DVD training programs on how to raise the hiring bar by using specific methodology that Impact Hiring Solutions has developed. By taking a step-by-step approach, you'll be able to improve your hiring processes that is measurable and has proven results. I feel privileged to have Brad with us today and to share ideas that will help in raising the hiring bar as far as your hiring issues go. And also, Brad, before we start, I want you to take just 30 seconds. Brad has a brand new program coming in about 30 days. It's a new hiring system. Brad, why don't you share what that's about, and after Brad gets done, we'll jump right in our program. And also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of today's program, and it's entitled, It's Time to Bring Laughter into the Workplace, and we can all use that after all we've been through. Mickey Williams is an international speaker on this topic, will be with us that day. So, Brad, just share with us briefly your new hiring program that's coming out, and we'll jump right in.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dana. I appreciate the introduction and the nice words. The system you're talking about is we've basically taken the system that we teach nationally, you know, through the Visage community, the CEOs and companies, and helping them, particularly for small to mid-sized companies where they don't have an effective HR department. We've taken our five-step system, which we call the Success Factor Hiring Methodology, and we've basically packaged it in such a way that companies can order this system online, and it encompasses all the tools and resources that a company needs to really implement an effective hiring process. Their CDs, all the templates, we'll talk about some of them today, the book, we've included your book, new book, for the assessment process, and we have templates, guides to ads. It just is a complete hiring system that you can literally look at a hiring system in a box and begin to implement that in your company. And that'll, we have one out, but the 2010 version is going to come out April 1st.
It's phenomenal. We're looking forward to that. Thank you, Brad. It's very cool. Why don't we jump into the topic? Why are interviews poor predictors? We also often hear that people walk in the room and like, oh, I want to hire them. But why don't you go into more detail on that, and maybe we jump to our first slide there.
Sure. Let me start by saying I think one of the problems with hiring that we've come up with, we've discovered in general, is that when most people or companies think about hiring, the first place they go to is interviewing. Teach me how to interview. And the problem is that interviewing is, what are you interviewing for, is always the first question. So we have a five-step process that you have to go through, and interviewing is just one step in the process. In part one, we walked you through in great detail all five steps. First is step, of course, is defining the role. We'll talk about that. The second step is sourcing. You can have the great job, but if you aren't bringing the right people to the table because you're not fishing in the right pool or you're fishing in a very shallow pool, you can have all the great interviewing questions and techniques you want, and you fall flat on your face. The third step, which we're going to talk about in great detail today, is how to really conduct an interview. And I believe interviewing has gotten just way, way too complex over the last decades of interviewing. Everybody tries to one-up everybody in the interview, and they try and assess all these characteristics about the candidate, their enthusiasm, their energy, their motivation, what drives them, and they're not psychologists to do this. And we believe most of that's irrelevant anyway, because at the end of the day, the interview is about, can you do my job? You may have all the great energy, enthusiasm, motivation, cultural fit, but if you can't do the job, it's worthless. It's not helpful. And the flip side is you can be highly qualified. But if you don't fit into our organization from a cultural perspective, you can't take that back on and adapt it to your company. It's still worthless. So the interview is very important, and we're going to cover that. And then the final, after the interview, you got to have an effective follow-up methodology to vet the candidate properly, to identify areas for further discussion, further vetting, to ensure the candidate is right. And then the fifth step is you got to have some other validation points of light to do that, of which one is, we use you a lot, Dana, for is the this assessment process, work style assessment. So there are a lot of things that go on, but I'd say the first thing to everybody on the line, if you don't have an effective hiring methodology, you can be as great at interviews as you want to be, but if you're not bringing the right people to the table and you're not sourcing the right people and you haven't defined the job properly, interviewing is going to be ineffective. We've learned that there are some number of things that right off the bat have interviewing problems. One of the biggest problems is the way people make a first impression. We're going to talk about that, but probably the number one biggest thing that impacts the interview more than anything else is the first impression. We talked a little bit earlier about we get into this desperation hiring. You know, if you think about it, most companies start the hiring process when they need somebody. If it takes 2 to 3 months to hire somebody, by the end of that third month, by the time work's backed up, staff getting over-stressed, working long hours, you're desperate. You'll take anybody that comes along. A warm body is effective. And that's why, like we talked earlier at the beginning, kind of before the program started, it's so important to think about upgrading your staff now and finding people ahead of time, sourcing ahead of time, so you avoid desperation hiring. We just talked about a little bit about how the process is flawed. Most of the time, we're going to see in a little while, the job interview, the job description is totally irrelevant to what we're looking to hire. Poor job descriptions lead to poor questions. And I left the number three out because I want to address that specifically, and that is we have embellishment and exaggeration going on in the interview by the candidate. How many times does a candidate tell you what you want to hear? But also by the company. When you're in desperation hiring, what happens is hiring managers often move right into a selling mode and trying to sell the candidate. So basically, often in an interview, you got two people, the interviewer and the interviewee, embellishing and exaggerating, lying to each other about what they can and can't do and what has to get done and what can't get done, and we expect it to work out at the very end. Not possible. So those are just some of the problems that happen with the interviewing process, why it is so flawed. We talked about probably the biggest reason. We did a research, and you can download this white paper on our website. It's called The 10 Biggest Hiring Mistakes. And it's based on a research project that I don't have time to go into, but we came up with what are the 10 biggest hiring mistakes companies make. Hands down, the number one biggest hiring mistake is they don't define the job properly. And when you don't define the job properly, what do you interview for? Who knows? Where do you source? you're sourcing incorrectly? How do you vet a candidate? How do you define performance management? How do you set a title? How do you set compensation? All goes out the door. So if you look on the left-hand side of your screen, now we've abbreviated this substantially, but this is actually a real-life example. We're looking for a title that says a director of sales, a sales manager. It doesn't really matter. The left side of the screen is a traditional job description. You know, we put out, I want them with industry experience. We list, I want somebody with these skills and this knowledge. We want these behavioral traits, the global thinker, high energy, team player. And I want them with 5 to 7 years of experience. I need a bachelor's degree. They're going to make sales calls. They're going to do sales budgeting. We list those out and a lot of the things. The left side of the screen, the problem is that's not a job description. And yet, in 99% of most companies, that's a job description. That's a people description. You haven't defined a job there at all. You've given me some duties, tasks, and responsibilities. But, hey, if I'm a director in sales, do you really need to tell me as a director, so I've got 10 years of business, what my duties and responsibilities are as a director of sales? Shouldn't I already know that? Shouldn't that be left blank and I fill that in? If you don't know the duties and responsibilities by now, you really want to hire this person? So that our position, that's not the job. The right-hand side of the screen in this particular case was the job. They wanted to hire a sales director who, within the first 12 months, could increase sales by 20% with margins of 3%, at least 3% increase in margins. They wanted a sales director that could build an independent rep channel in Europe within the first 90 days. They wanted a director of sales who could reforecast and implement a brand new sales forecasting and pipeline management system within the next 4 months. They wanted one that could revamp the sales and marketing collateral. And there were a number of other things there. I've only got so much room on the slide about the territories and the sales reps. The right-hand side is the job. So the question you have to ask yourself, if they hired a person with the left-hand side, all the interviewing they did was on the left-hand side of the screen, what are the odds they get the right-hand side of the screen? That's why interviewing is such a flawed process, because interviewing in and of itself does not solve that problem. We don't know what we're interviewing for. The right-hand side of the screen, we can interview on that, and I'll give some demonstrations later. Just kind of remember these four bullet points, and I'll give you some actual interviewing questions that demonstrate how we can tie the interview directly back to determine their ability to perform the right-hand side of the screen.
Hey, Brad, starting with a question, and I'm going to summarize it. How many companies do you run across that actually have something this detailed, and how much time does it take to do that?
We have never run across a company that has this detail. Unfortunately, I don't mean that flippantly or sarcastically. I never have. We run across 99% of the companies when we sit down and say, "Can I have a job description?" Or we start a search, or they're bringing us in to help source candidates. Or many times, I'll give you an example. I just did a vintage company, and they called me. I wanted me to help them interview for a position, and I said, Dan, I said, "What do you want me to interview for? What am I to see if this person's a nice person? Am I go have the baseball game with them?" They said, "Well, let me send you the job description." And I got the left-hand side. I said, "I still don't know what I'm interviewing for. You don't need me to determine years of experience. You can do that from the resume. You don't need me to determine if they got the right education and can do the duties, tasks, and responsibilities. They can do that." I can tell you the right-hand side of the screen here, Dana, when we met them, took 3 hours to put together.
Okay.
About 3.5 hours to put together.
Okay.
I mean, that's a lot of work. The left side's easy. The right side some work, but it drives the hiring process.
And it also helps the person to be successful, so it actually saves money in the long term by putting the investment of time up front. Is that correct?
Sure, because, I mean, let's face it, now the candidate knows exactly what's expected when they walk on board. There's no surprises. There's no, well, let's sit down the first day the director of sales walks on board and says, "Okay, I'm the CEO, you're my director of sales. By the way, director of sales, we're going to open an independent rep channel in 90 days. And the director of sales says, "I have no idea what you're talking about. I have some international, but I've never done that." And all of a sudden you look, back and say, what if expectations were totally misaligned? When you hire on the right-hand side, expectations from the day they walk in the door become aligned.
That's perfect. Okay.
Let me. This is for managers and above. Let me show you, for those of you thinking, well, I know, but I hire clerical, labor. It's the same concept. Nothing really changes. You just define success in terms of benchmarking. You could look at a customer service rep. You go to the left-hand side of the screen. And obviously, we abbreviate it heavily here. Or you can hire based on the right-hand side of the screen. Now, the right-hand side, again, a real example here. The right-hand side, this was actually what their very best people did day-to-day. And the customer service rep, this company's their very best. They had 8 service reps. Of those 8, 2 of them they thought were absolutely exceptional. And I asked the question, what makes them exceptional? And ultimately they came back. The reason they do their job so well is not because they're great listeners, not because they have customer focus, but this is how they demonstrate that customer focus. This is how they demonstrate they're a good listener. They're able to solve 90% of the problems on the first call. They make 100% callback the same day. They answer the calls in 1 minute or less. And there are a number of other things. If you notice, the right-hand screen, again, defines performance. The left-hand side of the screen, even their worst person, had everything on the left-hand side, and she thought she was a great customer service rep. The boss thought you were terrible. The reason she was poor is because they weren't doing the right-hand side of the screen. So when you define the right-hand side of the screen, I'll demonstrate in a little while how we can now interview, because this is about interviewing. A lot of this I'm just recapitulating because it was part of our first part one. But our belief is if you don't define the right-hand side of the screen, which is really the job, they didn't want the left-hand side of this. They wanted a person who had the left-hand side but could deliver the right-hand side, because the right-hand side was what the job is. So once you've defined that, now you can begin to enter into the interviewing process. I mean, some real basic things of the do's and don'ts in interviewing. You know, obviously, we get this question all the time, what kind of questions can we ask and what kind can't we ask? Well, I'm not a lawyer. But I can tell you that if you start crossing the line between personal questions versus performance questions, you're in trouble. And that, again, is why our defining the job in terms of performance is so important. Because when we get into interviewing, we aren't asking those personal questions. We're asking about delivery. I'm not asking somebody, are you married and have kids? Instead, I'm going to say, well, you know, you have to open up an independent rep channel in Europe in 9 days. And that's going to require an extensive amount of time, an extensive amount of travel in Europe, an extensive amount of time spent in Europe. Is that going to create any problems for you? Are you able to do that? I can focus on the job, not on the personal side of it. Obviously, one of our pet peeves is companies, for some reason, feel it's important to leave the candidate sitting in the lobby at that 4 o'clock interview. Let's go down and get them at 4:10. Now, in today's economy, you could probably show up at 5 o'clock and they'd still be sitting there. But I can tell you, 2 years ago, I actually had candidates walk out of the lobby after 10 minutes and say, you know what, I made sure I was here by 4 o'clock. Why can't they pick me up at 4 o'clock? And I asked hiring managers, what are your thoughts about a candidate that shows up 10 minutes late? Oh, I'd never hire him. Well, why is it okay for you to show up 10 minutes late then? Because maybe they're thinking, no, I don't want to work for you because you don't respect me. You know, don't be prepared. Don't read the resume. Don't score the candidate. You know, just be nice. Ask them something to drink. Get them comfortable. Offer them something to drink so they get comfortable, they get relaxed. I don't care how good the candidate is or how much they say. Every candidate is a little bit nervous in an interview just because they know they're getting assessed and they want to do well. So they're a little nervous. You know, just be prepared and be organized. There's nothing worse than when a candidate calls me back after the interview and says, well, Brad, I'm not sure how the interview went. They didn't seem organized. They really didn't ask me any questions. They started the interviewing off by saying, well, thanks. Glad you came in the interview for the sales job. And the candidate says, oh, actually, I'm here for the marketing role or I'm here for the finance role. They didn't even know. What does that signal, does that send about your company, the organization? So just some really basic things that show courtesy to that candidate that you may want to bring on board. Because this is really where the first impression starts. And this is so important, particularly when things are tight, meaning there's not a lot of candidates on the market, and you want to impress that candidate because this is the person you want to get, and they may have two or three things going. These few things can tip the scale in your favor. You know, we believe that interviewing is really a quest for the truth. And the best way to get to that truth is through examples, because examples validate what you did. Candidates all day long will tell us they did things. And I like to use the analogy that an interview is really, from a hiring manager's perspective, that hiring manager has to step back and evaluate, was this candidate in the accident? Were they standing on the corner watching the accident? Or did they cause the accident? And that's what an interviewing is. By giving those examples, it validates that. We could sit here all day long and I could tell you what a great golfer I'm in, how I golf every week, I practice three or four times a day, I've been in a lot of golf tournaments, and I swing the club at X miles an hour, I hit the ball 200, 300 yards. All that's great, but it's activity. When you finally say, well, Brad, that's great, but can you give me an example of a major tournament that you won, and how many strokes did you win that by? I fall apart. That's, you can, you know, think of Tiger Woods, the old Tiger Woods, but and the tournament. What makes him exceptional? They all do the same thing. If he wins, by getting those examples, it eliminates that knee-jerk reaction that I want to hire somebody. It also gets down to embellishment and exaggerate. If 100% of candidates embellish or exaggerate, and that's a low number, by the way. The actual number is somewhere between 125 and 140%, because most people do it more than once. When you get to an example, when you probe deeply on an example, that candidate either did it or didn't do it. All of us know that if we've done something, we've really accomplished something, we can talk about that specific example in the greatest level of minutiae that interviewer wants. When you're sitting there and they're asking, somebody's asking you a question about how did you do this, why did you do that, you've got answers around that because you did it. What happens is candidates often want us to think they did something when in reality they were standing on the corner watching the accident. When you probe deeply with an example and you ask for examples, you learn a lot about what that person did. And in fact, I suggest when I work with my clients that they sit down, when they sit in and audit their other managers, to see if they're good interviewers or poor interviewers. But one of the things they should be listening for is how many times do they hear them say, can you give me an example of that? Can you give me a specific time when that happened? Can you cite the incidents where you did that? They really draw those examples out. So it also, as we mentioned here, it teaches the candidate to say, wait a minute, I can't bluff here. I got to have real-life, true examples, and if I didn't do it, it's not going to happen. I just was interviewing in Houston, as we said earlier. And one of the guys we were interviewing said, well, I bring this team together. We get a complicated contract in this sales process. And we bring the team together and we go through the issues one by one to evaluate the contract. And I simply said, oh, great. Can you give me an example of some of the issues that come up? He said, well, we all kind of just talk about things going on and we, you know, different people talk about different things. And I said, no. Can I have specific examples of an issue? And the last one that you did, believe it or not, the manager sitting right next to me, after four times, he could not give us that example. He was making it up. He probably never said, he probably brought the people together, but he was not in the room talking about examples of issues, a simple thing. He kept going back to, well, we talk about the different terms in the contract. Give me an example of the term you talk about, and what are the issues? Is it pricing? Is it due date? Is it terms? Is it how payment is? What are some of them? He couldn't come up with any of them. When you ask for examples, you eliminate embellishment and exaggeration.
So that goes back to, that's perfect, with the quest for truth, which is applicable to every position, whether it's customer service,
oh, yeah,
administrative assistant, or a C-level position.
Yeah. Administrative assistant can sit there and say, one of my biggest strengths is that I'm really good at helping my boss get organized. Well, number one, I don't know what that means. The way I get organized, bam, may be different than how you get organized. So can you give me an example of where you completed an organizational process for your current employer? What did you do? Did you organize your schedule? Did you put a system up? Did you screen their emails now? How do you help them? And we find that this candidates here really, when you get them specific, they'll give you vague terms, but when you get them specific, this is where you separate the great candidates who really did what they did, can do top performers from those that are average performers. One of the things that we believe is really important, especially on key positions. Now, you define a key position however you like to define it in your company. It's all different. Some, it may be an administrative assistant. It may be a receptionist. It may be the CEO. It may be a sales rep. You define what's important, what's a key position. But we believe for every key position, you should conduct a phone interview. And, in fact, Dana, as you mentioned in our hiring system we've got coming out in April, we actually have template in there for how to conduct an effective 20-minute phone interview. We got the questions, the assessment. It's all right there in a template form, and it's part of the system so that you can do an effective job of doing that. We also have a template, by the way, that helps you put together a success factor snapshot or the right-hand side. And it's a form you fill out, and you go through it, and you end up with what are those success factors. Those templates are available. The phone interview is so important because it's really a screen. I'll just give you some information. There are really only three things you can measure on a phone interview. You can generally measure someone's energy and enthusiasm. I mean, you can tell by my voice whether I'm a high-energy guy or a low-energy person. You can tell how well someone communicates. Do they use proper English? Do they use the word like to connect every other sentence? Are they able to put together a thought process to a question? And then finally, you can get some level of technical skills or experiences. But those are the three primary things you can get. I would suggest to you that the first two, the ability to communicate and the ability to high energy and enthusiasm, are probably the most important of those two. Of those three, I'm sorry, the most important of those three. If you don't have that, why go on? If they don't have energy and enthusiasm and they can't communicate well, again, let's assume communication is an important part of the role, why do you even need to bring them in? Why waste an hour and a half of your time? If they don't have that, and that's important in the job, you've saved yourself hours of time.
The question that came in, Brad, can I ask it about phone interviewing?
Sure, we're on the topic. Go ahead.
Okay, and also, I'd like to encourage anyone to submit questions, and again, at the end of our program, we're going to open the line up so you can talk to Brad directly. The question is, when should a phone interview take place, and generally, just everyone has questions about phone interviews?
So I hope I'm answering some of them. If you've got others, now's the time to ask them. Generally, phone interview should take place once you screen the resumes. I think it should take place for the top candidates. I wouldn't phone screen everyone. I think every key position you should have it on, do a phone interview, and I think they should last 20 minutes to 30 minutes. You don't have to conduct a full interview. Again, you should have some two or three game breaker items that you want to validate on a phone interview. This is a sales rep. I want someone who communicates well. If you get on the phone interview and they're unable to communicate or put together a complex sentence, you don't need to go to the next step. If you get them on the phone interview and they're flatlined, they don't have any energy, they can't answer a question, they're monotoned, they sound like they're falling asleep, and you need a high-energy person, you want that person? Now, maybe if you're just doing, somebody's going to be doing web design and they're just going to sit on a computer all day, it may not be important. So you can save yourself an enormous amount of time and weed some of these candidates out. And everybody on this line, everybody who's done any interviewing knows there's nothing worse. You get a candidate and within 5 minutes you think to yourself, why did I bring this candidate in? What did I miss? And a lot of times a phone interview can screen those out ahead of time.
Actually, somebody just wrote a comment and they said it's also very respectful to the candidates.
Sure. I would tell you, when I talk about that in just a minute, too, the other thing it does, when I talk about coming up here very, very shortly, it diffuses the number one, hands down, biggest problem with interviewing before it happens. And we'll talk about what that number one, hands down, biggest problem with interviewing is. We mentioned it earlier, but we'll talk about that. It diffuses that and sets that aside. Let me walk you through what we think is the structure of an interview, and then we'll walk through it. I mean, the interview goes, depending on the level of person, may go an hour to an hour and a half, depending on the level. And depending on the level, you may have 20 hours of interview. If you're hiring a CEO, you could spend 20 hours worth of interviewing with that person. You're hiring an accounts payable clerk, maybe an hour, maybe 45 minutes on with one person and 45 minutes with another. So the time is going to change. The length of the interviews will change, and the amount of time you spend with them will change. And that's all relative to the position and how important it is, how impactful it is on your company. But overall, the structure should be about the same. You should spend the first 4 or 5 minutes, you know, setting it up, building rapport with that person, letting them get comfortable, letting them get a little relaxed. They know they're in a stressful situation here, particularly if they're unemployed right now. Especially right now, if they're unemployed, they're in a stressful situation. So you're not going to see the real person until you get them relaxed and comfortable. And that may take 3 or 4 minutes. One way to help them continue to stay relaxed for the next, oh, say, 10 minutes is walk through their work history. It's easy for them to talk about. They don't have to do much thought. They know what it is. So you can just kind of walk them through their work history. So you've spent now 10 minutes, 15 minutes letting that candidate get comfortable, letting them know, is this going to be a stressful interview? Is this going to be a you just sit there and answer my questions interview? Is this going to be a dialogue type interview? Is this going to be a high-pressure interview where you're just going to fire questions at me for 25 minutes and I got a rapid fire? You're giving that candidate the time. By the way, if you really want to have an effective interview, it should be only one kind of interview, and that's a dialogue. For those of you that like to just fire rapid-fire questions at it, you're missing a major part of their communications ability. A good interviewer will be 60-40, 75-25, the candidate talking 75% of the time, you talking 25% of the time. Those interviewers who like to put a lot of stress on people in an interview because it's a stressful job, an interview is generally not the same kind of stress one encounters in a job. You're better off to get an example of where they've been under stress to see how that aligns with you rather than conduct it in an interview because it's a different kind of stress. You can then – oh, somebody moved it. Yeah, let's go back to the sales strategy. Are you moving the slides, Dana? Is there happening by itself? But anyway, so let's go back here. So you review the work history. Walk through a little bit of time. By the way, there are only four kind of questions – well, three kind of questions you can ask in an interview. All questions fall into one of three categories. They either fall into what we call the throwaway questions, which are kind of those – we don't really want an answer, just, you know, tell me about yourself. We don't really want an answer, but it just gets relaxed. We just kind of, it's not important, it's a relaxing game, you know, icebreaker type questions to get the candidate comfortable. The second kind we have are what we call informational questions. These are important questions because it's gathering information about the candidate, their work history, some of the types of maybe about their companies, how big the companies have been, the size of their organizations, basic information we need to know to see how well the position may align with our position, how many people they supervise, how many, you know, accounts payable, how many invoices they process, a salesperson, how big was your average sale? So is it high-volume sales or low-volume sales? Those basic kinds of information we want to know. The third kind of what we call the pain questions. Now, these are the questions which are the most important. We get to those success factors. These are the things, you know what, if you don't do these things or you can't accomplish these things, I'm going to be in a lot of pain. If you're my customer service rep and you can't solve 90% of the questions on the very first call, it's going to create a lot of pain for me and my customers. If you can only get to 50% because you're not capable of getting there, it's going to create a lot of pain. if you can't open up an independent rep channel or increase sales by 20%, it's going to create a lot of pain. And so these are the questions that really impact the organization. And so keep that in mind as we go through this. So once you get past this, the work history, we're going to talk about that very shortly. We believe there are five core questions you need to ask in every interview. By asking these five core questions, which we're going to go through, you can get to an 80% determination that this person can do your job. And I would suggest to you, if they can't answer these five questions, the other 20% is irrelevant. You shouldn't hire them anyway. So all the questions that people ask in an interview, they're good questions, but the important thing is they can't do these first five. You don't even need to ask those questions. They can't do your job. Like we said earlier, if high energy and enthusiasm is important in the role and they don't have it, you don't need to ask them questions beyond that. You may need to keep the interview going, but you don't have to. And then finally, you want to get the personality and cultural fit. We call this, and you'll see that coming up, the adaptability question. It's great that you're a phenomenal salesperson, a phenomenal controller, a phenomenal human resource person. You are the best customer service manager on the planet over here. But if you can't adapt your personality, your style, and your cultural fit to our company, you may be a great X. You're just not the right X for our company. So it's their ability to adapt to our culture, behavior, management style, computer systems, resources, customers, environment, distribution channels, all these things that make us different than this other company, they're not the right person. And then finally, the last 10 minutes should be this closing process, getting questions from them, and creating how you want to let this candidate go. How do you want this candidate to exit? We always want them to exit, by the way, on a positive note. Interviewing is a PR event. The last thing you want to happen to you is that candidate be going to a networking meeting, sitting next to another candidate. They're chit-chatting over breakfast, having a cup of coffee, and one candidate says, oh, yeah, I've got an interview at ABC Company. And the candidate you interviewed last week, who left there with a bitter taste in their mouth because you showed up late, you weren't organized, you conducted one of those rapid-fire questions, they didn't get a chance to talk, looks at that other candidate you've got interviewing this week and says, oh, gosh, you know, I interviewed there last week. Well, did you get to meet Brad? And says, oh, yeah, I got an interview with Brad, that's right. What a jerk that guy is. I kept me waiting in the lobby for a half an hour. By the way, when you go over the interview, just sit there and shut up, because all he's going to do is fire yes or no questions at you for the next 30 minutes. He's not going to offer you anything to drink, and at the end, he's just going to stand up and throw you out the door. It's a PR event. Do you want that to happen, or do you want the guy to say, oh, you're going out to ABC Company? I met there last week. You're going to interview with Brad? What a great guy. I don't know if I got the job, but, boy, great company. Great, you know, seemed like a great guy to work for. He's already building rapport for that person for you. These are your salespeople going out. An interview is a PR event, so you want to make sure you leave it on a positive note. Let me tell you one of the biggest negative feedback we get from candidates that tick candidates off, and I think rightly so, is that hiring manager will say, well, thanks for coming in. You know, give us a couple of weeks. Here's my card. You'll hear back from us in 2 weeks. If you don't hear back, give us a call. That hiring manager has no intention of returning that candidate's call, because he's not going to hire him, has no intention of even sending him a letter. So now this candidate sends him emails following up because the hiring manager told him to. Have questions, give me a call. Give him the business card. And they don't ever return the phone call. If you're not going to do it, treat your people. Don't say anything. Just say, thanks, I appreciate you coming in. You'll hear back in the next 2 weeks, and then send them a rejection letter. But don't promise something. Teach your hiring managers. Don't promise something they can't deliver. That would be my strongest encouragement to you. So that's kind of the interview structure, that 1-hour time frame that you may want to think about structuring if you don't have that already. So let's talk about the most important things happen before the interview even takes place.
Hey, Brad, Brad, quick question. A question came in. Do you have a template for a letter to send to candidates as a rejection letter by any chance?
We do not.
Okay.
We believe that we've asked that many times, we've asked it to put together, and we will not do it.
Okay.
That should be that's like asking, how would you like to get a canned thank you letter that from a candidate that you know is the same one let's say a candidate comes back and meets three people. You meet those three people, and you all got the exact same letter. No, we believe that should be a personal type letter to that candidate. Now, a lot of it may be boilerplate and say the same, but there should be some personal note in there just to indicate it's unique to you, whether it be just a company name, thanks for coming in, we know you, I like your experience at this company, but it should be personal.
Okay.
It should be personalized a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
There are two things that happen before the interview that you need to be recognized has to happen. I mentioned to you, here it is, the absolute positively, hands down, the number one biggest mistake or the number one biggest reason interviewing fails is we make a strong first impression. When you're in desperation hiring and you walk out to that lobby and there sits that perfectly dressed candidate, makes a great first impression, great handshake, looks you in the eyes, a great introduction, you walk back to the interview, back to your interviewing office, and they're able to put together two or three complex sentences without using the word like every time, you got this strong first impression. Most hiring men at this point in time, especially if they're in desperation hiring, thinking, wow, fine, I think I found my candidate. If they have that first impression, what kind of questions are they going to ask? Softball, weak, leading questions? You know, Dana, we pride ourselves here on team player. We look for team players, and being a good team player is important to us, Dana. Now, Dana, how do you feel about working in teams? We lead those questions. And the reverse happens, too, by the way, we make a negative first impression. I've had over 10,000 interviews in my life, and I still make strong first impressions. You have to train yourself, train your employees, train every single person to learn that regardless of that first impression, good or bad, you're going to set that first impression aside. And it's very difficult to do. But you have to train yourself to set that first impression aside, put it in the parking lot, recognize that you brought this person, you did a phone interview with this person, they passed the phone interview, so they must have something good about them while you brought them in, and you're going to conduct a thorough, in-depth probing interview before you revisit that first impression. That's one of the reasons the phone interview is so important. It diffuses the first impression.
Brad,
and there's nothing more powerful than that happens in the interview than the first impression. Like, if you walk with nothing today, this is the most important dynamic that will change your interviewing process.
Brad, a question just came in. What are your feelings about telling, let's say they come in, you have this gut feel, you're validating that something is not quite right through the process that you're sharing, and the question is, what is your feeling about telling people on the spot that they're not interested in the candidate for the position?
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to do, and I think a lot of candidates will respect that. It depends why and when it happens. If it happens in the lobby, because you made a first impression, I don't like your handshake, this is a weak handshake, you got a problem. If you're 30 minutes into the interview and you've gone through something, you can look at the candidate and say, you know what, you've got a good background. I do this all the time. We were interviewing a candidate in Houston. You've got a great background. I like your energy and enthusiasm. But for this position, where I see a weakness, we really need someone who has managed A, B, C, and D, or has done A, B, C, and D, and I see that's a part of your weakness. Then the candidate respects that. They'll look and say, yeah, you're right, I'm probably not right for this position. And they'll respect that. And so I encourage you, but again, temper that with when you do it. Lobby's probably not a good place. 30 minutes in, and you both discover something that isn't appropriate. The candidate knows they're not qualified right off the bat when that happens. Just address them. Thank them for coming in. And if it's early on in the interview, give them a little bit of time to respect their time that they came in and just address the question. The other thing is, let the candidate know you're going to have a structured interview and you're going to ask for examples. Just tell them right up front. you know, I'm going to ask for a lot of examples. I like to interview based on examples. So throughout the interviewing process, I'm going to ask you for some specific examples, and we're going to probe down on those examples. And then I always like to say, is that okay with you? And they'll say yes. So now they're set for the fact that you're going to ask them for examples. That happens before the interview takes place, but please recognize one thing to take away. Forget everything else. Remember, you've got to set those first impressions aside. I cannot stress that enough in the interview. And we spend a lot of time in our workshops and webinars focusing on this issue. So we believe there are five things that all hiring men, top talent, bring to the table. And so these are the things you want to look for. The first three are behavioral, the second and last two folks in the job. We believe all top talent is self-motivated. We believe all top talent, they deliver the results. And we believe all top talent have some type of leadership or team-building skills. Those are behavioral. If they don't have those, and those are important to your job, all the rest of the interview is worthless. It's meaningless, because if those are important and they don't have them, they can't do the job. The last two deal with the job. The first one, you're looking for past successes similar in size and scope and environment. And the fifth one we talked about earlier is, how do they adapt to your company, your culture, your environment? They can do all the great things in number four and have the first four, but they can't adapt that to your company. Just means they're a good person, not the right person. So I mentioned to you that we have five core questions we want to ask in an interview. And here they come. The first one is the question to ask on a phone interview. This is probably the best question you can ask on a phone interview, but I've got to set your expectations. When you ask this first question on an interview, be prepared that 75 to 80% will fail this question. And that's because if you're looking for the top 80%, or top 20 percentile of candidates, I want candidates that are the top 20% performers, by definition, 80% aren't going to fit. I like to ask the question, can you give me an example where you've demonstrated initiative? Now, I like to change that a little bit. You can footnote this. I like to ask the question, can you give me an example where you demonstrated high initiative? If they can't get past this question of demonstrating initiative, they're not the right person anyway. This is culture. You may get an answer back about culture that they think is high initiative, and you're sitting back thinking, wow, in our culture, that's, you're not even standing still. We consider that to be just a normal part of the job. You're going to get burned out here, or you're not going to be able to keep up with us. Great question to ask on a phone interview. Then we like to follow up with, can you give me an example of you executed a project flawlessly? Now, you can ask flawlessly or not if you want. But I like to ask the question, give me an example where you executed a very difficult project. You can clarify this a little bit. You can say, what I'm really looking for here, Dana, is I'd really like an example of where you had a difficult project. Maybe it was short budgets. Maybe it was short on resources. Maybe in the middle of the project, the parameters changed. Maybe in the middle of the project, your key person got sick. But no matter what happened, you had to go up. Over the barrier, around the barrier, through the barrier, under the barrier, you find a way to get that project done on time. If that's part of your job or you're the physician, you really want to understand that. Then you move into leadership, a most significant success leading a cross-functional team on a major project. You know, I like, because of the environment we're in, I've changed that question a little bit. I will ask the question, can you share with me your most significant success leading a cross-functional team on a major project, and I'll add this, in very difficult times. That's what we're in right now. I mean, everybody's a great leader when everything's going great. But when things are tough and the bullets are flying at you, does the team stay with you or do they abandon you? And so let's get to the leadership. Cross-functional. In today's world, we're matrixed. I mean, we're interfacing with all kinds of different functional areas. And we've got what many refer to as authority without responsibility. I'm sorry. We've got responsibility without authority. You can never delegate responsibility. You can always delegate authority. And so if Dana's working for me, it's easy for me to have him do it. Because Dana, if you don't do it, you're not getting your bonus. But if Dana's my peer, and he's already working 60 hours a week, and I need to get my project done, I need Dana's help, how do I get Dana to work 65 hours that week? That's leadership. So then once we get past that, the next two questions, really deal with putting them in the job. And this is where the success factors take place. Let's go back to the salesperson. I may ask you, say, Dana, one of your biggest challenges when you come on board is to increase sales by 20%. Can you give me an example where you've done something similar in size and scope in your background? We have a saying. In fact, it's our tagline. Good interviewing is about putting the candidate in the job before you hire them. Most interviewing process, hiring process, they talk about their experiences, their background. They talk about all this great stuff and then hope and pray that when they come on board, they'll be great. We believe let's put the person in the job before you hire them. So if when we define the job, when I ask Dana if one of my success factors, the one thing Dana's going to have to do to be successful is increase sales by 20%, when I ask Dana that question, Dana, can you give me an example where you've increased sales by at least 20% in your last position in the interview, right there, right now, we're talking about my job, what I need him to do. Now, we haven't talked about it yet in my environment, and we will, but we're at least aligning with my job. If Dana comes back and says, I've never done anything like that, or can't give an example, and you probe deeply, which we'll talk about, then he's not the right candidate. He may be a great candidate, but he's not the right candidate. Even though the left side, you can box check his years of experience, he's got the right industry, he's had the right size organization, he tells you he's a team builder, he tells you he's a global thinker, and he's got high initiative. Probably not the right guy.
Brad, a question just came in. It's kind of a long question, so I'm gonna encapsulate it. And the question's around a typical sales manager will say, "Well, I need to do 30 days of assessment of the organization before I can come back and really give you a real picture as to how I would deal with this."
Okay.
And the question is, how do you get around that? Because, they need the information from us in order to really know.
Sure. Well, that really what you're getting into is the last question, Dana. So I'll answer those collectively with the last question.
Perfect.
Because you touched upon the last question. So once I've had this candidate interview, I've interviewed the candidate. Let's take my sales director. I've had him interview. I've told him one of his responsibilities is going to be to increase sales by 20%. Generally, you bring him back. He'll meet with maybe the marketing manager. He'll meet with the CFO, the controller. He'll meet with the rest of my team. That may take a week. Now, I would think if you've got a top talent person and you just told him you got to increase sales by 20%, I would think when a top talent person, when he comes back and he's meeting with the rest of my executive staff, he or she would be asking questions relative to the gathering information. You meet with the operations person. Well, I got to increase sales by 20%. I meet with the operations person. Can you handle the capacity? What are some of the problems you're having with sales right now? If sales increase by 20% over the next 12 months, what will be the challenges? What have been the challenges to sales growth in the past? So I'm gathering information about how would I do this? Now, I got to get that 20%. Do they even have the infrastructure to do that? If I meet with my inside sales team, do you have a CRM system to track that? How does it work? I gather information. Good top talent, when they come back, will do that. The second thing they'll do, top talent. Usually during the time I meet them, let's say I'm the hiring manager, I'm the president, this person reports to me. They come back, they meet two or three people in my team, and then I'm going to meet them again. Let's say 2 weeks have passed. Wouldn't you think top talent, knowing that they're going to have to increase sales by 20%, would be researching my company, would be researching my industry, would be gathering information to help understand that rather than waiting? So when they come back to me, I've met them the first time, I like this candidate, I bring them back, they've met my three executives on my team or my three key players or my one key player, whatever that might be. The following week, they come back and I have my follow wrap-up meeting with them. That's what I'm going to ask this final question, Dan, that ties exactly with what you say. I'm going to say to them, Dana, you know, in our first meeting, we discussed the fact that one of your biggest challenges when you come on board is going to be to increase sales by at least 20%. You know, Dana, now that you've had a chance to meet my whole team, you've had a chance to probably do some research on our company and our industry, You know, Dan, what would be your 90-day plan to do that when you come on board? I still haven't answered your question. I'll get to it. But wouldn't you think after all that time, this person is going to have thought about that and be able to come back with some kind of answer, a top talented person? We talked about putting the candidate in the job before we hire them. Think about that question. Dana, what will be your plan to increase cash flow by increase sales by 20% once you come on board? Aren't we having the exact same conversation now that we're going to have day one when Dana comes on board? Why not do that now and see if he even has a clue how to do it? But now let me answer your question, Dana, or the attendee's question. So let's say Dana comes back and says, well, you know, I really don't know, Brad. You know, I need time to assess the company. I'm thinking to myself, really? Didn't you have that time to interview with all the rest of my team? Haven't you had 2 weeks to think about that? I'm thinking that. So I'm going to say, okay, Dana, understand. Okay, Dana, tell me. I've set an hour and a half aside for this interview. Tell me, what information do you need to answer that question? And if I don't know the answer, I'll bring in my CFO or I'll bring in my marketing person, and they'll get the answer for you. Go ahead, Dana. Ask me any questions you need to help that you think you might need to know that you don't have right now. Go ahead. I'm going to put that candidate back on the spot. If it's a sincere issue, that candidate will come back with some very good questions and information they need to know. And we can begin to have a dialogue around those questions. If that candidate comes back with some superficial, childish, canned, generic questions, they're trying to avoid it. Good top talent will have done their research. Good top talent will have questions, and it may be legitimate. I don't know. I've got some questions to solve that. Great. What are those questions? Let's have that dialogue right now. You're going to have a day one. Where would you go? What would you assess? What information do you want to collect?
Hey, Brad,
what would you need?
Brad, somebody just wrote a note and said, amen, thank you.
What does that mean? I'm not sure if that's true or
they're appreciative, but, they're appreciative of someone to actually say it as it is. I think that's what it means. So whoever wrote that, thank you.
So let me just say, because we're going to get short on time here, after you finish those five questions, the interview just begins. This is where the probing starts. You can conduct a thorough, in-depth probing interview and get to 75% of where the candidate can do your job with five simple words. You ask the five core questions, you ask for that example, and then you go to number three. All you got to do is then probe deeply with who, what, when, where, why, how. That's it. Who was on the team when you accomplished that project? How would you implement this? What would you do different? What would your thought process be? Where would you go to get that information? How did you do that in the past? Who was on the team? Why was Dana and Brad on that team? What did you want from Brad? What were the three critical choices you had to determine to make that decision on that project? When you come on board, what are the two biggest challenges you think we're going to encounter to increase sales by 20%? Who were the vendors you looked at, and what criteria did you want from those vendors to make that decision? What were the two biggest challenges? When Brad and Dana were in conflict or didn't agree on a methodology, how did you overcome that? Every single one of those questions is a who, what, when, where, why, how question, and it helps you probe down. And we teach our, when we hire recruiters, we teach them and we interview with them, co-interview with them to determine do they probe deeply with who, what, when, where, why, how. Generally speaking, if they're making it up by the third who, what, when, where, why, how, they implode right in front of you. You will see a change in body language. You will see a change in their tone of voice. You will see a change how they sit in the chair. Eye contact, if they're making it up, this all changed. All you have to do to conduct a thorough, in-depth probing interview is ask the question for an example and then probe deeply. One final bit, and I'm going to turn it back over to you, Dana. Number five, you will hear a lot of interviewing going on right now with the we question. Well, we did this, and we were this, and we were this, and we did that. And, well, when we got together, I don't know, unless anything on this line, if somebody on this line is hiring we, then that's okay. Few people hire we. Most people hire you. So you got to pull we off the table. And you simply do that by saying, Dana, you know, I understand you're using we a lot, and I don't doubt for a minute you're a team player. And in fact, Dana, we're going to talk about leadership and team player in a little while. But, you know, Dana, for this example as we go through this, I really want to understand what you did and what your role was on that team. So focus a little bit on what you did. Don't be afraid to use the word I a lot. I'm not going to think you're arrogant or egotistical, but I really want to understand what your specific role was. So use I when you have to. And the first word out of that Dana's mouth is going to be we. You know I told him that. Dana, that was we now. Was that we, you, the company? Or Dana, was that we, the team? Help me understand the we. You got to pull we off the table. Every recruiter, every coach, career coach, every outplacement from every book says if you don't use we, that hiring manager is going to say he's not a team player. And believe me, I've been there. I've seen it. Or, boy, they got a big ego. Well, I'm sorry, you're hiring. The person should talk about I. You want to know what they did, not what they disguised as the team, not what the committee did. I mean, there's no accountability within a committee. Everybody points the finger at everybody else. What did you do? So pull we off the table. If you hear we a lot, when you co-interview or audit your team now, you sit on that interview, see if they're good interviewers, listen for an example, teach them to set first impressions aside, and teach them how to pull we off the table. Those are some things you can do to simply improve the interviewing process. I would suggest to you, pull the complexity of interviewing out. Make it very simple. All you really care about is, can they do my job in my culture, my environment, and be successful in my company? We ask so many questions that are irrelevant around that, and we beat around the bush, and we ask all these indirect questions instead of asking the specific question. Ask those five core questions, follow up with who, what, when, where, why, how. And let me repeat, there's five things to do in an interview. Do these five things, and interviewing will change dramatically overnight. I'll give them to you one more time. Here we go. Number one. Set your first impressions aside. Number two, conduct the five core questions. Proceed with the five core questions. Number three, ask for examples. Number four, probe deeply with who, what, when, where, why, how. And number five, pull we off the table. If you can get your team to do those five things, literally, and I mean this sincerely, interviewing will improve dramatically overnight. And with that, Dana, I'll turn it back over to you.
That was just fantastic. And we're going over our time, but this is such a huge topic that for those of you that can hang on just for a few more minutes. Brad, I got a question for you. Anything else after the interview that everyone could do?
Well, I think the biggest problem after the interview is the interview assessment process. In our experiences, the interview assessment process goes something like this, Dana. I've interviewed Dan. Now, I'm not the hiring manager. Maybe Bill over here and Mary's the hiring manager and asked me if I'd interview Dana when he comes in next week. Sure. And all after I interview on Monday. And let's say Mary is the hiring authority or the person that this candidate is going to be working for. I interview on Monday. Well, usually sometime Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you know, Mary bumps into me at the proverbial waterhole, Starbucks, and asks that in-depth probing question, hey, Brad, oh, you interviewed Dana on Monday. You know, what'd you think of him? And within about 2 seconds, I give you a thumbs up, a thumbs down. I give you, I like him. Well, he seemed like a really good person. Loser. And then who's ever the least loser or the person we like the best, because my latte is now ready, we move on. There's the interviewing assessment process. Companies need to get a better methodology after the interview to evaluate and vet the candidate. And again, a little plug here if I can, Dana, in the hiring suite we have come out, we have a template. We call it our 8-factor success template. There's 8 characteristics you want to go over after the interview to vet this candidate. And it's a matrix. You fill it out. Very simple. And it allows an in-depth dialogue about, well, Dana, why did you think there was initiative? You know, and I don't think he did have initiative.
Is that available on your site, Brad?
It is today. We're going to pull it down because the templates, we're going to pull down the templates.
Okay.
And we're going to consolidate them into our hiring system. But if you want them, yeah, you just go up to on our home site, impacthiringsolutions.com. You'll see products up on the top menu. Hover your mouse over that, and hiring managers will come down, and you'll see a list of our things. It'll say templates, or it'll say the complete hiring system, or whatever it may be.
Okay.
So it is available. But I think they need a better vetting system. And then, Dana, I think the final thing is they need a validation process like the 16 PFU provide. But that after-interview assessment is so critical to get away from that silly what'd you think of them question.
Okay, so doing the best interviewing, doing the best reference checking, which we haven't even covered, and we won't do that today. Well, maybe that's a part three. And then doing an in-depth personality assessment or work style assessment and validating it all together should help the cause,
I take it.
Okay.
Yeah, we use it all the time. You know, trust but verify, the Ronald Reagan comment. But if you don't have a good system after the interview to vet the candidate about what are the strengths, what are the weaknesses, why didn't you like this candidate? Doesn't mean he won't fit in my area. You just didn't like him. Maybe, maybe not. But let's have a dialogue about it. What did I didn't like him mean? Is it important? I mean, you know, I'm not going to go out and I'm not dating the person, or I'm not going to go to the baseball game. I didn't do a job. So that would be my other assessment to you. And we have this tool. And many companies have their own tool, and I would suggest it's working. Don't change it.
Okay. That's phenomenal. For those of you attending today, we're gonna share the slides and the audio so you can share it with other members of your team. In just a few minutes after we conclude this show and turn off the recording equipment, we're going to open up the line so you'll have the opportunity to talk to Brad directly. You'll see on your screen an area to register for our upcoming May 4th open line. It's time to bring laughter to the workplace, and we're very fortunate to have Mickey Williams as an internationally recognized speaker, and we all need some laughter in our workplace. So please sign up today, reserve space for yourself, and let us know if you'd like your staff or other colleagues to attend. In the next few days, again, we're going to be sending the recording and PowerPoint to you so you can share it with others. Brad and I want to thank you for your time today, and I want to thank Brad for all the ideas, insights, expert background, and everything else you've done for us, Brad, for sharing today. Again, we're going to open up the line in just a few minutes. It's just phenomenal. If you want to spend some one-to-one time with Brad or talk with him about more specifics about issues you're facing right now or challenges, email Brad directly. I would highly recommend Brad's book, You're Not the Person I Hired, and he's coming out with a brand-new hiring program. It will be out in the next 30, 60 days, and if you want to find out about that, email Brad.
Dan, I just want to say you can get the book available right on our website, impacthiringsolutions.com. If you want to get it, it's there. It's actually cheaper than Amazon, so I would encourage you to, and we'll ship it out the next day.
Perfect. The information shared today is the property of Lighthouse Consulting Services, LLC, located in San Monica, California. Our mission statement is to bring effective insight to your organization. If you'd like more information on our services, please write me at dana@lighthouseconsulting.com. If you have other topics you'd like us to address, please let us know. Thank you so much for your time, for joining us today. We look forward to having you join us for our next Keeping on Track open line program. Have a great day. Please hold the line. I'm going to turn off the recording equipment, and then you can talk directly to Brad.